Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Bosmang Aeron is back, recovering what is arguably the climax of the book. We'll talk a little bit about that. Is it a climax or an anticlimax? Comic Steve Osborne and I cover the season finale of season 5. We get to hear Steve getting his feelings about Jon Snow in this podcast, which I'm pretty excited about. Steve and I are launching two new podcasts. One is called Perfect Stranger Things. The other is called Cocoons of Horror. I think that they're both available now. The Bird's Eye View this week is a short excerpt of Steve and I's coverage of The Last Duel. Only mild spoilers here, but go see it. Go see The Last Duel and then follow us on Cocoons of Horror. Without further ado, here is Bosmang Aeron.
Hello.
Hey, no video, although I like the red light, whatever. It's very horror themed, I suppose.
Do you want me to turn the video off as a messing your bandwidth up, or?
Yeah, you can turn it off. It seems weird for me not to have it and you to have it.
Your face. Get it off. can you make less of that happen, sir? Just
a little bit less of you would be nice.
A little bit. Oh man. This was a short chapter. This was the Jesus wept of Game of Thrones.
You know what? A lot of these chapters are short. It's a little bit goofy in that, you know, you're supposed to, you know, the premise of this podcast is to kind of make a meal out of each chapter. But especially with this first book, a lot of times Martin will like, no, I said what I want to say. I'm moving on. Let's get back to whoever we're, you know. Also, I guess with Ned gets more chapters than the others.
That's true. I remember this being a bigger production. But I don't know. I really enjoyed reading this chapter. It's like so dynamically written and also just so deliciously ironic on rereads.
Yeah, this is one that really rewards you for the reread, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
So I guess one could argue, Aeron, that this is the climax of the book. What do you think about that? Bold statement.
It's definitely... I feel like, okay, when, cause I was one of those dirty, filthy casuals that watched a show before I read the books.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was watching a show, I got to admit that I kind of sat up in my chair a little straighter at this scene, but I think the true climax, the one where it's like, it definitely puts you into, oh, this isn't your father's Tolkien story, is when Ned actually gets chopped. Right. So like, I think it's definitely the penultimate part of the story. Do you think it more befits a climax?
I think, all right, I've been thinking about this all day, actually. So I'm glad that you said that. Because I could make an argument, and I think I can convince myself of the argument that this is the climax of the book. Just of where it's placed and all of this business about, you know, if you're following the main plot of the story, it's kind of building to this point. And I think that upon first read, this would absolutely strike me as the climax. But I think I could also convince myself that this is something of a false climax. In other words, it feels climactic enough, mm-hmm, so that when Ned loses his head,
mm-hmm,
you're like, you were sufficiently fooled into thinking, oh no, that, you idiot, that wasn't the climax. This is the climax.
Yeah. That's definitely more of a gut punch, but I think this is a little bit of a gut punch because it's written like on first read, this is just Ned completely in command. Like, oh, look at this, these Lannister people practicing out in the yard, mm-hmm, doing all this dumb show for my benefit.
Yeah. Ugh, Cersei's such a fool.
Cersei must be more of a fool than I thought. Why didn't this woman extricate herself from this? I gave her every chance. And meanwhile, like, there's so many flashing in, you know, subsequent reads, there's so many flashing red warning signs that he just completely blows through.
Mm-hmm.
But like, it does remind me of like, you know, reading a piece of heroic fiction where the guy is just, you know, he doesn't want any bloodshed and he wants everything to be orderly. And he feels real bad about getting vengeance over his enemies and getting the upper hand, but by God, he's going to get it. And, You know, there's a great scene where he reflects when he's going into Joffrey's throne room. There's all the Kingsguard and the Lannister right. guards all lined up. And he's like, this is the last time I was here is I was chasing Jaime Lannister off the throne.
Sure.
I wonder if Joff will be as easy. He never doesn't consider whether it's possible or not, or whether he's going to get it done. Just like, oh, will it be as easy as the last time?
Right.
And that's a lot. That's pretty funny. Pretty good ha-has on second reads.
You know what? I wonder if a lot of the Ned derision that I've experienced pretty much as for as long as I've had a relationship to this book, the meta commentary around the book is about deriding Ned Stark, how stupid Ned is. And of course, this podcast is as guilty as any, but I think that I wonder how much of that is something that you only realize upon reread. Like, how many readers, if they're honest with themselves, read this for the first time and would have made decisions differently than Ned would have?
It's tough.
Or if it's just like, oh yeah, we're brilliant. We're strategic geniuses because, of course, we have the benefit of hindsight.
Well, it's tough because, like, I think you are thinking that it's following the kind of medieval fantasy logic that a lot of these, you know, heroic epics follow, where it's like, you know, even when it's against all odds, mm-hmm. you should always stand up to evil because standing up to evil is good. And,
right.
you know, honor is and truth are right. And those things are going to win out in the long term. And, you know, that's the key. I do think, like, in long term, like, that stuff tends to, you know, a long arc of history has been towards, you know, justice or whatever. But in the short yeah. term, it can be a bitch. Like, it's like, you, even if you're counting cards on Vegas, you can lose $100,000 in an hour just because the odds are against you, you know? Yeah. So, like, but that would never happen to Aragorn, right? Aragorn would never.
I was just thinking about Aragorn. I was thinking this passage may have an analog in the Two Towers when Aragorn and Gandalf go in to see Theoden. And he's like, you know, he's been totally corrupted by Wormtongue or whatever. And they go in and basically they speak truth to power.
Mm-hmm.
And Gandalf uses his magic exorcism stick to fix Theoden, and the good guys win, right?
Well, and it's another, like, another great example from the holy texts is when Aragorn rides up to the Black Gates and right. a book only or extended edition only, the Mouth of Sauron meets him, like this, you know, lieutenant of Sauron. Uh-huh. And there it's kind of a false diplomacy, but he's like there to accept their surrender. And Aragorn essentially tells him, nah, you ain't shit. And tell Sauron to go stick this up his butt. And he cows the guy.
Yeah,
like, right. like it's almost like the force of his righteousness exposes the mouth of Sauron as a coward, and he just collapses. And then, of course, Aragorn wins. But right. like, and get George Martin's like, okay, but what if those Black Gates open and all nine Black Riders come out and just tear right. Aragorn in half, and it's some kind of, you know, Robert Rodriguez film, and it's just blood everywhere and the bad guys get slaughtered? You don't seem as cool anymore, do you? And Ned is Aragorn that just gets his ass ripped into at the Black Gates.
That's right.
You know, because, and even I think there's this, I was doing a little bit of side reading on this, and someone asserted, I didn't look it up because that, you know, you only paid me to do one chapter, Anthony. But someone says that in, I think, A Clash of Kings, Cersei, in one of her private recollections, thinks back to this and thinks that if Sansa hadn't have told her, given her advance warning, even Ned going up and, you know, essentially giving her 24 hours notice to get the hell out, wouldn't have given her enough time. Sansa gave her the additional time to grease all the palms and do all the dirty deals and all. So, like, Ned almost beat Cersei if it weren't for the carelessness and naivete of Sansa.
Interesting.
He still would have won, or at least yeah. independent of Cersei, who is also a giant idiot. So I don't know.
Okay, I'm going to read a synopsis and then we can talk more about it.
Okay.
Ned wakes to the sound of Lannister men practicing at joust. He notes that this means that Cersei hasn't fled the city and laments this fact. After breakfast with his daughters, Pycelle informs him that Robert is finally dead. Ned holds back his emotions and calls for the small council to be convened in the Tower of the Hand. Selmy, Baelish, and Varys arrive. Then Ned learns that Renly has fled the city with Loras and company. Pycelle reads Robert Baratheon's final letter. Then Ned asks to be confirmed as Lord Protector. Before confirmation, the council is summoned to the throne room to voice fealty to Joffrey. Joffrey, from the throne, demands coronation within the fortnight and oaths of fealty immediately. Cersei, after ripping up Robert's letter, advises Ned to kneel and return safely to Winterfell. Ned reveals his treasonous conviction that Joffrey has no right to the throne. Swords are drawn, and the City Watch, to Ned's surprise, has taken the side of the Lannisters. Baelish takes his knife back and holds it to poor Ned's throat. So, do you want to talk about a character, a theme, a plot point, or shall you and I climb the ladder of chaos?
Do I have to pick just one?
You don't, but this chapter is heavy with the ladder of chaos. I mean, you got Baelish's fingerprints all over it.
It's true, true. Let's start there. Because this is something that was often said that there's some differences in book Baelish and show Baelish.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always quick to defend show Baelish because I liked the show and I thought it, you know, and I didn't think it besmirched the character by any stretch of the imagination. But one thing, when I was thinking about this, I was thinking about some of those old criticisms that, like, show Baelish in season one, everyone says, like, no one trusts Peter, you know, no one trusts Littlefinger. Littlefinger's untrustworthy. Littlefinger, mm-hmm. you know, only a fool would trust Littlefinger, et cetera, right? Book Baelish is not like that, especially in the first book. Peter Baelish is friend to all. He makes your political problems go away. If you're, you know, out of gold dragons, he can rub two together and make four. He's all about, like, ingratiating himself to people and keeping their confidences. It's like, I feel like I feel like a lot of people think that, like, Peter Baelish was always the sneaky, hardcore master manipulator, but, like, he had the massive base of power. And you're kind of seeing in Baelish in the Game of Thrones book on as kind of like getting as high as he can go and then really do, you know, like cashing in his chips kind of like.
Hmm.
But, like, I will say, kind of as a defense of Ned Stark, in book one, Littlefinger seems a much more likable, noble, you know, friend the cats, family friend. Like, it seemed like a lot less foolish of Ned to trust him than it did in the show.
Well, agree, here's the thing about Baelish. I mean, mm-hmm. this guy has got brothels over the city. He's taking Ned to brothel after brothel and, like, telling him, "Hey, fondle the breast here, there, Ned. You know, you blend in." This is all very distasteful. Yeah, I guess that's true. This is all very distasteful.
But it doesn't work on Ned. It would work on, like, almost everybody, you know, else. And, right. like, it's almost like a moral, it's almost a moral disapproval, not like, you know, objectively, well, Peter Baelish is a known liar and he's a con man and stuff. It's just like, oh, you know, I guess, can a Vegas casino owner not be
right.
a moral upright man? Probably not, actually, no. But,
Going for him is that Ned distrusts Varys, and Littlefinger mm-hmm. and Varys seem to be at odds. And so it's almost sure. like Ned's thinking, well, I've got to trust somebody. And of course, Kat trusts him. So, all right, I'll trust him. And then in this chapter, it really, like, the metaphor is heavy. It's like Ned's got a broken leg that he's hobbling around on. And he's literally leaning on Baelish walking into the throne room.
That's exactly my note says. He's literally leaning on Littlefinger to stand. And yeah, it's subtle.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So, no, I think that this is another one of those cases where hindsight makes us all geniuses. Of course, yeah. No one should trust Littlefinger, but there are hints. Yeah. There are hints throughout, you know, that, you know,
oh, yeah.
Tyrion, for instance, kind of calls Kat out on her bullshit and says,
mm-hmm.
look, what are you talking about? That came out of Baelish's mouth. No one trusts Baelish. But of course, at this point, Kat doesn't trust Tyrion. So it's sure. kind of a brilliant little trick that you're thinking, well, actually, I don't know if I can trust anyone in this book. So, but you have to make alliances nonetheless.
I also like the contrast in the sisters that they kind of reinforce, you know, Sansa, who's always tied more to the Southern, you know, Tullys, is on the prospect of returning to Winterfell. She's sullen and disconsolate.
Right.
But Arya, like at the breakfast table, is wolfing down everything because she's going back home. I thought, you know.
Well, yeah. And she gets.
That was super interesting.
Yeah. And she gets to bring Syrio with her. Or so she thinks, right? So.
Well, that's but it's also like there's so many portents in this episode, like Syrio's final lesson. You got time for one last lesson, and then Ned cautions it, but a short one,
right?
And we know this is going to be their final lesson, and it will be curtailed by several Lannister and Kingsguard goons showing up. But I thought that was interesting too, because I was kind of like, yeah. Oh, gosh, I want to read the next Arya chapter.
Yeah, one other note from the breakfast scene that I noticed. So, you know, Sansa's totally ticked off that she can't say goodbye to Joffrey. And she's, you know, she's just acting like a brat. And Septa Mordane says, "Your lord father knows best."
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's like, oh, geez, this just like hits you in the face on reread. It's like, this is a total subversion of the father knows best theme. And clearly, Ned does not know best. But, you know.
No.
So, anyway. Yeah, Septa Mordane gets that last line, I suppose.
Swing and a miss.
I got the sense that Ned, from a previous chapter, I got the sense that Ned is carrying around the Valyrian steel knife that was used to, you know, cut Catelyn.
Is that true?
Yeah, I think so. I think in a previous chapter, it talks about him kind of getting dressed to go see Robert for the last time. And he takes the Valyrian steel dagger and he puts it in his belt. And it gives you an idea that that's the dagger he's carrying around. And in this chapter, that's a little different than the show, is that Baelish actually grabs the dagger from Ned's belt.
Presumably that... Valyrian steel.
Right. If I'm tracking, that is the knife, and he holds that knife to Ned's throat, which, you know, has a little bit of extra juice to it, narrative juice to it, I suppose.
Yeah.
And then maybe even foreshadows the fact that Ice is the knife that's going to be used to take off his head.
I wonder I don't know if you've seen the teaser trailer for the House of the Dragon, but they have that damned Valyrian steel dagger front and center. And
I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah.
A nice little Easter egg for fans.
It's being carried by Queen Alicent Hightower. Yeah. I wonder if they're building in some kind of like dagger of destiny, kind of like greater world building for that dagger.
I wonder if there's someone out there doing a PhD in media studies that's talking about the evolution of the movie trailer. It's becoming something of an art to create a movie trailer that has at least a dozen Easter eggs to it, right? Because
especially
you want it to be
stuff,
like
for nerd shit. Yeah.
Yes, you want it to get poured over on YouTube, and you know you want to give people
you want the 30-minute breakdown videos on YouTube.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah,
exactly. Yeah, so it's interesting, you know, of course they want to hype up the show or whatever, and that's an easy way to do it. You just got this prop laying around. Why not use it?
Yeah, for sure.
I thought it was interesting that Ned thinks that Cersei will, he's kind of surprised that she hasn't fled. You know, he thinks that if I I've got this dirty secret and all I have to do is threaten to reveal the secret,
you'll do the right thing.
And the truth will shine forth and, you know, she'll scurry, you know, she's like a cockroach. She'll scurry away from the truth. So it's almost like he's wearing the truth like a shield of honor or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of, it's bizarre to him that Cersei has not left. And I don't know if you've been watching Succession. Have you been watching Succession?
Oh, sore bald move topic, Anthony. No, I have not.
All right. Anyway, I won't reveal any Succession stuff. But there, let me just say this, because this actually has an analog in the real world.
Sure.
If you are a political leader without a sense of shame, it's kind of a superpower.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, of course Cersei's not going to flee. She doesn't feel shame in the same way that Ned would feel shame. She's going to push forward. You know, she's not going to give up ground because someone else has a true narrative. All she has to do is come up with an alternative narrative and sit right where she's sitting. And in fact, fleeing might make her look guilty. And mm-hmm. I think that this is all sort of lost on Ned.
Yeah. And the fact that, like, just the world doesn't operate on his values. Like, he thinks, like, the idea that Cersei is going to be thrown down is a foregone conclusion, you know, because that's the right thing to do. It's the rightful heir, blah, blah, blah. That is an interesting point.
The thing I wanted to talk about was the odds of Ned actually succeeding, even if the City Watch was on his side. I was interviewing the medievalist earlier this season, and basically this guy was saying, you know, that a knight is worth about 10 men on a battlefield. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that, you know, that the knight is horseback and trained to fight on horseback. But so in the book, it says that if he has a city watch, then the Lannister men are outnumbered 5-1. But aside from Jaime Lannister, the entire Kingsguard is there. And I'm wondering, even if they're outnumbered 5-1, you've got like 6 of the best knights of the entire kingdom, plus the Hound. I think that this is going to be a pretty even fight.
Yeah. That might be the case. 5-1 advantage, and the knights are worth. Because, like, that's the thing is, I guess, like, are the gold cloaks the equivalent of like a medieval foot soldier, or are they equivalent? Because, like, don't they have plate mail, and they have helmets, and they have spears with iron tips?
Yeah, I mean, they've got. Here's the other thing: they've got spears. I mean, I think a lot of the weaponry is like, if you're actually thinking about medieval warfare. You know, these swords are not going to be a match for full on spears.
Yeah. Yeah. Like five spears with the range and in those quarters, like maybe that would be the thing that would carry the day. And Ned's all wounded. So it's like, yeah, Ned is him pretty high as a duelist, but he's out of commission for this fight.
He's out of commission. And you've got the Hound in full armor.
And the Hound is one of the top killers in all of Westeros. It's pure killer. So
yeah, I'm just going to read this little section that talks about the Hound. With a single sharp thrust, the nearest gold cloak drove a spear into Tommard's back. Fat Tom's blade dropped from nerveless fingers as the wet point burst out through his ribs, piercing leather and mail. He was dead before the sword hit the ground. Ned's shout came far too late. Janos slashed open Varley's throat. Kane whirled, steel flashing, drove back the nearest spearman with a flurry of blows. And for an instant, it looked as if he might cut his way free. Then the Hound was on him. Sandor's first cut took off Kane's sword hand at the wrist. His second drove him to his knees and opened him from shoulder to breastbone. As his men died around him, Littlefinger slid Ned's dagger from his sheath and shoved it up under his chin. His smile was apologetic. I did warn you not to trust me, you know. You know, every now and again, you get the sense that Martin can write an action scene.
Yeah, he doesn't do it. He ducks a lot of them, but when he writes one, he writes one. And it reminded me of, have you seen Rob Roy?
Yeah, it has been a long time, though.
But, you know, the climactic fight between him and a guy from Pulp Fiction, where, like, that when he says,
Roth? It's not something Roth.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
And when they said the Hound cleaved that guy from, like, shoulder to breastbone, I think of that, because, like, Liam Neeson cleaves that guy from, like, shoulder to hip bone. It's truly one of the more horrific sword wounds I've ever seen in a movie. I always think of that when I think of that scene.
Notable introductions in this chapter, none. I could not find a single notable introduction, unless I'm mistaken.
A lot of notable exits, though.
Yeah, that's right. Notable departures. Poor Fat Tom gets it. Mm. We see Varley depart. We see Kane depart. I'm assuming that there's a number of other guardsmen who are just, you know, red shirts hanging around that also depart. And then, of course, the show versus book differences. I think the biggest difference in this chapter is there is no small council before this throne room scene.
Yeah.
You get the whole build up. You know, they're in the Tower of the Hand, and of course, Pycelle's already looked the letter over, and that's where Ned learns that Robert's dead, and, you know, he's holding back his emotions. This all happens kind of in the hallway in the show. You know, Ned's just, like, limping along, and all of a sudden, he gets word from someone that King Joffrey has summoned him, and he's like, King Joffrey, what are you talking about? And they said, well, the king's dead, so... we have a new king.
Yeah, I guess I kind of prefer the drama. It's hard to say because, like, the book, you know, has that build up. But I guess I like the pure drama of, like, Ned coming in with the sealed thing, Barristan looking at it. It bears the king's seal, unbroken, you know, like.
Yeah.
It really moves.
Sir Barristan, I believe no man here could ever question your honor.
King Robert's seal, unbroken. Lord Eddard Stark is herein named Protector of the Realm, to rule as regent until the heir come of age.
May I see that letter, Sir Barristan? Protector of the realm. Is this meant to be your shield, Lord Stark? A piece of paper.
Those were the king's words.
We have a new king now.
Yeah, and if you have an economy of time that you're working with, why reveal the letter twice? You know, there's a simpler and shorter way to tell that story that's just as effective, right?
And it gives a lot of interior Ned time for him to reflect on what a wise and just ruler he is, and how he's just doing all this immaculately. So there's, but yeah, you don't really need that, or would appreciate that on a TV production.
One other show difference is that in the book, Marcella's in the room, and she actually asks, sort of innocently, like, "Does this mean Joffrey's not king?" You know. It's all, you know, a very innocent question that I think,
right.
I think that you kind of need a child's voice. But just one other difference. Again, I don't know why Marcella's in the room. This is probably not the place that you want a child, but, you know, I don't know.
Got to learn the family business sometime, kid.
I guess so. All right, Aaron, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me back on.
Absolutely.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of King's Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now Steve and I cover A Mother's Mercy. This is the finale of season 5. This is the episode where Sansa and Theon escape, and Brienne executes Stannis, and Tyrion begins to govern Meereen, but it is also the episode where Jon Snow gets his. Just a reminder that Steve and I have launched a new podcast called Perfect Stranger Things, where we're covering the first season of Stranger Things episode by episode. So if you're looking for a New Year's resolution, rewatch Stranger Things with us. What could be more fun than that? Here is Steve Osborne. Steve, what was your reaction to the end of this episode?
So I think the last time we talked, I kind of criticized fans who get like, oh no, not this person. Oh no, not that person. Mm-hmm. I was a little bit like, oh no, not Jon Snow.
You got your feelings hurt.
I did get my feelings hurt a little bit. And I guess, so it caused me to do things that I do look back on episodes and try to figure out like why this, why that, or why that. I'm a little bit like, well, why wouldn't you do this before he goes off to the wildlings and, you know, essentially brings members of the Night Watch there and puts their life in danger? Like why after?
Well, that's fascinating. Let's get back to that part, because actually there's a lot of talk about that particular issue, but
okay.
I think before we get there, I want to hear like...
I always feel disproportionately satisfied when I say something that's like, oh yeah, no, that's a point of conversation already. Like, because sometimes, you know, I get nervous about these things sometimes because it does feel like a book report.
Yeah.
But I know I've read the... So what's kind of wild is like, I'm learning now at 44 years old. I'm like, oh, so is this what it's like when you read the book you're supposed to do a report on? Like you'll do good?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Like, that's crazy. If I could turn back time, I would have.
Some teacher would have told you along the way, you actually have to read this stuff.
Yeah. Crazy.
All right. So I want to hear like just the visceral sort of, did you see it coming? All of that business.
I did not see this one coming. Like, I mean, let me rephrase it. This episode, I think maybe more than previous, it was a lot of like any time that the camera would be on somebody, I'm like, something's coming like to their head. You know, just like I had that feeling, right. You know, it had that horse on fire episode feel, right?
Yeah.
Like when Brianna's standing over Stannis, I'm like, oh, she's not going to do it because something's going to happen. Like, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Ramsay's going to come out and like eat her face off or something. And it's like, it just felt like that kind of an episode. So I was pretty on edge for a lot.
Well, and I think that a lot of it was like, okay, so Stannis dies, there's the big death. And Myrcella dies, oh, there's the death. And Mirren Trant dies, oh, there's the death. or Miranda dies, there's the death. And so you kind of have your quotient met.
Yeah, exactly.
Looking back, if you would have left it like that, you're like, nah, you just killed off characters I don't care about.
Right. And the assumption being like, okay, what you've done is you've just given me a volume, a high volume over, you know, like the big death or something. Right.
Sure.
And Stannis is nothing to sneeze at in terms of.
Yeah. He's probably the biggest.
Because of the way it goes down too. Talk about like Game of Thrones showrunners doing the opposite of what they normally do and still delivering the same effect. They have this big sort of anticlimactic, like it seems incongruous, but it's, you know, an anticlimactic death scene that has as much gravity as a big battle.
Yeah, sure.
Talk about, this season, the much maligned season 5, which you could argue that, okay, we've seen 5 seasons. That's not really an argument we have. You could argue that it's the 5th best of the 5, you know, right. Maybe.
Yeah, sure.
Just because there are a little more clunky moments.
Mm-hmm. It's like saying that Ringo is the 4th most talented Beatle, you know?
Sure. I think that's a spot on, you know, or going through the Appetite for Destruction song list and, you know, ranking them. And it's like, yeah, but like a lot of these would be number ones on, you know, if they had just waited for their second album to throw in Mr. Brownstone, you know, we wouldn't have had to have an acoustic remake of everything else.
Yeah, so in that way, Game of Thrones is really a victim of its own success. How do you follow up season 4? Well, you do your best, and one of these things isn't going to work. And part of the reason it doesn't work is because it doesn't work in the book. So you give it a go, and then you realize,
sure.
It didn't work on screen either. You know that.
Yeah.
So
well, and also I think we talked about like the religious zealotry and just how much religion played part, not just one, but like multiple religions on display.
Yeah.
And really like the idea of zealotry, right? And I could see that like if you're not into that concept, well, you're not going to be into season 5 very much because it's pretty heavy with a lot of those things.
Oh, yeah, sure. You got the faceless man, you got the fire god,
you have, whether you call it religious or just cult, you've got like the Sons of Harpy concept, and then at the end, what we have is you have sort of the Night's Watch following the same level of zealotry, right?
Yeah.
These people know that there is a White Walker issue. They just know that. And logically, you could follow where John is going, but this idea that like they kill him really shows a sense of isolation, in my opinion. Like this idea of I understand like the young boy,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's kind of a powerful moment, but like, you know, because you did get to see him watch his parents die, so that makes sense. Yeah, there's a lot of that, right? So religious and zealousness, I mean, obviously in this one, I mean, it's a long drawn out shame walk.
That was horrible from stress, and I think it takes a good 45 minutes.
I thought that this was like there was a point where, you know, sometimes on YouTube they'll just start showing ads. Like I thought that was gonna happen.
A lot of product placement if you look carefully.
It's not poop they're throwing at her, it's Nestle's Quick.
All right, so Heather's reaction to the ending.
So Heather's reaction is interesting. And so I don't know if it's, so she's gotten to be very intuitive about things. I had my before we started the episode, we were talking a little bit about, all right, what's Arya going to do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it seemed like it was setting up for, okay, so he likes young girls. She's going to find a way to get in there. I said, I bet you she steals the face.
Yeah, she's so like, you called
then,
it.
So and that becomes a conversation where she's like, well, can you steal the face? And I'm like, yeah, there's a room full of faces. Take one. And so there was this like, nah, I think the faces are just like, they're not like, you don't put them on. Like, because she's like, no, they come off, they go on. Like, he did it with like a little bit of like a sleight of hand thing or a magic thing. They're not like actual Mission Impossible faces. This was a conversation. So then, you know, the scene starts taking place. I'm like, gonna rip off that face. so I was right with that. I just didn't, I mean, interesting, there was just no like I don't know if it was because, like, hey, we got to cut some things because we need to add 40 minutes to the shame walk. But there was no, like, how did she get in there? Anything. It was just, she's just there.
Well, because I think that that's on purpose because, well, I think most fans would have guessed that third girl is her. It's like, it's the rule of three. It's like, of course the third girl is going to be her. Right.
Right.
But if you want some little element of surprise, if you show how the sausage is made about how she gets into the brothel,
right,
you're kind of stealing a little bit of that shock at the end.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, I it does pay the audience a little bit of respect, saying like,
sure,
I think you'll get there. You'll figure. You don't need everything laid out.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, you didn't watch Drogon's journey back to Marine. You know.
Yeah, exactly. I like, you know, he's getting into adventures. He's like meeting a cow.
Gets distracted by berries, wonders if maybe he's a vegetarian now. It's a fun little romp, you know. He makes friends with the rabbit, but then he realizes he's hungry, eats the rabbit, gets a taste for it, and kills 8 cows.
Yeah.
Now that I mention it out loud, I'm kind of disappointed that we didn't get that.
That's why people hated season 7.
It's all about
Drogon becoming vegan for a time.
And it feels a little ham-fisted in the overall. It's like, okay, we get it. It's probably better for you long term, but like,
all right. So Heather's reaction.
So to the Jon Snow.
Yeah.
And so again, I was talking about how she's intuitive about things. Like, she knew that the kiss was a poison kiss.
Oh, she did.
Yeah, she's like, oh, she's dead. She just poisoned her. And I was like, wow, that's pretty great. You know, like, because I'm like, sometimes you're just caught in the moment. You're just going for the ride. But then other times, you know, you're trying to, what's this mean? What's that mean? And Heather got that one. So then went out the Jon Snow scene, which was just, again, it was fairly relentless. And I think for her, and I don't know if she's in denial or if she's being intuitive, she's like, I don't think this is the end of Jon Snow.
Well, I mean, how many steps did it take? I mean,
That's the thing.
They're doing their best to say, no, you're not going to recover from this because this is the fourth. This is the fifth. And that one's right in the heart. And you're seeing his eyes open and the blood come out, you know.
No, I know. So, I mean, like, I'm like, no, that's the thing. But I don't know if there was a point where she was just like, after everything that had gone through this season, if it's like, no, I'm not ready to. Not really closed the book on Jon Snow yet. You know what I mean? It's like, I think because Jon Snow is another, like we've talked about, has been a slow burn. And she revealed she was never really that into Rob. And I don't think she was all that into Catelyn either.
So this one feels more like Ned. I think there's a lot of parallels here between Jon and Ned because basically Ned and John part ways on the road and they have this conversation about like, you know, you're going to tell me about this is like second episode, I think.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, next time we meet, I'll tell you about your mother. And so you're kind of thinking, all right, well, there's more here. We're going to find some resolution eventually. Those two never see each other again. Ned goes south. We get introduced to King's Landing with Ned, through Ned's eyes. But once we have a feel of King's Landing and we know all the personalities there, Ned's not really needed anymore. You've been introduced. And the same way Jon Snow goes up, he introduces you to the White Walkers, everything that's going on at the Wall. Once you have a good handle of everything that's going on up there, you know, Craster's Keep, all that business, all of that, you get introduced to that through Jon's eyes.
Yeah.
Once you have done that, Jon Snow has kind of served his purpose.
That's fair. Yeah, and I guess the Ned parallel does feel similar, too, in the sense that we only get Ned's backstory through anecdotal stories or this or that.
Yeah,
but Jon feels like almost you could have felt like this is the Ned prequel. You know, the way that he develops and the way that he sort of learns to lead based on what he's observed. And once he's thrust into it, like he makes really tough decisions. I mean, you look at what Jon Snow does and it's like, as a leader of all the leaders we've seen, you know, outside of Tyrion, like he might be up there in terms of like big picture, like it's different to say, okay, we're going to take a risk by sending our people off to war versus we're going to take a risk by making allies with former enemies. I mean, we see some of that sometimes, but this one was done with compassion as opposed to purely like a land grab.
Well, you know, and you could almost draw a parallel between John and Danny here, because Danny is trying her best to make peace with the city that she's conquered, right?
Right.
And even to the point of marrying one of these guys just for politics.
Right.
And then
it's a big picture moment where she's like, I don't know this guy.
And then John is doing something similar, but it's sort of in reverse. It's like he marries Ygritte and then learns to love this free folk culture, learns that they're human too. And then instead of conquering, you know, he takes the step of vulnerability and invites them into his territory. Maybe this is what the show is telling us. Like, yeah, that kind of weakness is always going to be repaid with certain death.
Yeah. It's, yeah. And that has been sort of an ongoing reminder that any attempt at altruism, any attempt at settling things down is folly, because it goes back to the parallel that, or the metaphor that Tyrion and Dany use when talking about the wheel.
Yeah. Huh. Right? Yeah, sure.
Like he's, and so she's like, I'm going to break the wheel. And that is the goal, right? I think that that's the intent. I think that was Ned's intent to some degree. But the problem is that how do you break the wheel while being the wheel? It's a good metaphor, because the wheel is, if the wheel is effective, it's in motion. And most of the time you try to break a wheel, the wheel breaks whatever's trying to break it.
Okay, that's interesting. So my take on the wheel is that maybe I've always thought about this incorrectly, but the way that she describes it is that this house is on top and then that house is on top and they all just sort of spokes in a wheel and the common people always get crushed. Mm-hmm. That's what I think that that's what she says. And so to me, that sounds like we need a new form of government. But maybe I'm thinking about that wrong. Maybe she's just saying, I don't want spokes on a wheel. I don't want there to be a wheel. I want to be so supremely powerful that if I order the land to be in peace, it just is in peace. There's no great families.
Yeah, so there isn't this idea of rotation or this or that. It's like, look, let's just, look, I got this. If the wheel is completely broken, there's no turning of power.
I'm not going to share any of my power with great families anymore. If I say no more war, there's going to be no more war. And that's just the way it's going to be. You know, I think she has a sense that, like, that's who she is. Eventually, when she comes into her own, that's the kind of power she's going to have. Yeah, I think I've been thinking about this wrong all of this time. Like, new form of government, maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe it's just like, I just don't want to share power.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's all right. So I wanted to, so let's talk about the sort of chronology. Like, why not kill Snow? Like, why doesn't Alistair kill Jon Snow before they let all the people in?
Right. So that's why, again, that's why, like, I had posited the one idea that, like, maybe on some level they do get it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, he does make, because he makes a fairly compelling argument that's kind of hard to argue really against. I mean,
that's interesting. I wouldn't have thought of it that way. Okay, so here's what I was going to say before. So he does not go north of the wall in the books.
Okay.
So all of that stuff at Hardhome that we loved, it never happens in the book.
Oh, wow.
Which was fantastic, right?
Right.
And so gives you a little glimmer of hope for the post content part of the show. So he doesn't ever leave the wall. So there's not a question of before or after he leaves the wall with Alistair Thorne. So
there is this moment. This is in the book.
As far as we know, John's dead, bleeding out in the snow. That's kind of how the last published book ends. And here's
what
happens.
Considered a traitor? Why is he considered a traitor if he doesn't go north of the wall?
He sends word to the free folk, and then they kind of come, and he allows them in. Like, he's the one that opens the door to let them in.
So time-wise, that makes a little more sense, right? So it's a preemptive strike. In the show now, it's
not a preemptive strike, because the free folk are already south of the wall in the book, too.
Oh, okay.
The issue is that John never goes to Hardhome.
Okay.
So, and the other thing about what happens in the book is that there's this other warg who has this giant, like, boar that he's kind of eyeballing John and John's eyeballing him. And he's a little bit worried about, will his wolf attack the boar? And so he locks up Ghost. So Ghost gets sort of like put in this dungeon area, kind of like Danny puts the dragons away. And as soon as he locks the wolf away, at least I was thinking in the book, it's like, oh, well, you're dead meat now because you just locked away your wolf and people want to kill you. Like a lot of these wildlings are thinking about killing you and, you know, just you're just totally vulnerable at this point. And then sure enough, he gets stabbed anyway. And Sam, yeah, Sam is sent south to become a maester. Maester Aemon goes with them. So it's Gilly, Aemon, Sam, and then the baby. And then Aemon dies on a boat. So it's a little different, but it's in the same way. You kind of get the sense that he's lost all of his allies in the books.
Right. Not that Sam was going to really protect him. But
not really. But, you know, Sam could be good for, like, you know, go let Ghost out.
Sort of. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Hey, talk about dying on a boat. I think the way Marcella dies, I think that would be how I'd want to go out.
You and your boats, man.
Well, first, a beautiful woman kisses you. And then you get on a boat. I love the whole thing.
And then your uncle die in your uncle father's arms.
Well, maybe not learning that my parents are brother and sister. I like that. Maybe that's a part of it. But even then, it's sort of like you don't see your own death coming. And maybe if you get a little bit of news to distract you toward the end. So it's like it totally catches you off guard and there's a little blood on your nose. You're in this cool little galley in the boat area and you just kind of faint. That is my way of going out. Perfect. It's a perfect death.
Okay.
How about you? How do you want to go out?
Not drowning. I know that.
Okay. Not venomous snakes, I'm assuming.
No, I think probably like falling from something really high sounds pretty good.
Really?
Seems like a fun way to go.
Huh. Okay. So the moon door.
Yeah, I'd moon door.
Really? Oh.
Yeah. So, okay. So does that happen in the books? The Marcella?
No. Yeah. None of that has happened yet. I mean, it could happen.
Oh, actually. Oh, yeah. So, because, yes. Yeah, so, okay. So that's fascinating. So I tell you right now, the thing that, the takeaway for Heather on this one that probably made her the most upset was Arya going blind.
Oh, really? Okay, so let's talk about Arya for a little bit. So I kind of ruined that for you last episode when I said she went full Tarantino.
A little bit.
So, but, I mean, you probably would have gotten there without me.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't. I knew that I would have been shocked if she didn't complete the task.
But I was just thinking, like, the way that they lit the scene, it was like very Kill Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And once the killing starts, the eyes getting plucked out, she like stabs out his eyes. And then there's a little bit of that's kind of foreshadowing what's going to happen to her. She goes blind.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's just as nasty as all get out, right?
Right.
And then she says, instead of becoming no one, she makes him no one.
Right.
So all of that is sort of gross and fascinating at the same time. But the thing that got her, the thing that got Heather was that she went blind.
Yeah. She's like, I can't have her be blind now. Like we've been following this journey and it's like, and I think Arya, not that you think anything good is going to happen to anybody at this point, but you're hanging on to these narratives and you're trusting the narratives, you know, like anytime sure. The Dany narrative feels like a slog, you're sort of like, yeah, hopefully it'll pay off, you know, Tyrion's in a box. Okay. Hopefully this will pay off, you know, and you go through all of those journeys and then you're like, all right, well, you know, Arya's kind of got up and Sansa's already sort of like, okay, well that didn't work out with Arya. You're like, okay, she's certainly, you know, never going to be the same and on it goes. But then it's like, well, I think it felt like I gotta follow a blind character now, you know, and how's that going to work out? And so I think there was a bit of compassion because it's like, geez, this poor girl, now she's blind on top of it. And
well, you ever see the movie Blind Fury
with Rutger Hauer?
No, I have not. Yes. It's, you know, I wouldn't recommend a rewatch. But it, you know, a little Blind Fury, Daredevil sort of thing happened with Arya.
Well, and I'm sure, right? I mean, that's kind of where it feels like it's going to go. But at the same time, it's like,
it's not like she's not going to become an assassin. I mean, that's
right.
We got too much invested in the assassin. And that could have been, I mean, that could have been your big thing at the end. Because in the same way that Cersei gets her power taken away from her, right when she's kind of coming into her own, this something similar happens to Arya. How much do you want to talk about the Cersei thing?
Less time than it took for her to walk.
Okay. Just too much. It just...
You think so?
It's too much.
I mean, it was relentless, man. But I think it, I dug it.
I will say that her character so much more complex now than it ever has been.
True.
And you kind of got to see that happen on Lena Headey's face in that, I don't know what it was, 5 minutes of that walk.
Well, because her face changes so much, so frequently.
Yeah, it's just like she's going to like be stoic, and then you just like, she's totally, I mean, everything. She feels all of the feelings, Steve.
Right. Because here's the thing, and this is what makes this show, I think, so compelling, is that you're like, you're reluctant to feel any compassion for somebody like a Cersei.
Mm-hmm.
But the time that the showrunners take to make it go on and on and on, I think feel like the audience becomes like Stannis's wife at some point.
Sure, yeah. It's supposed to be uncomfortable, and that's probably what I
believe.
I firmly
believe this person deserves to be, you know, whatever. Look, this person's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
They deserve whatever comes to them. And then they're like, all right, well, why don't you watch them get the justice you believe that they deserve? Mm-hmm. And then it's like, man, I don't know. That's a rough watch. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I think that's important, because there's so much of that happening in the show that is easy to dismiss. So that when you're put in that uncomfortable situation, it changes the way that you react. But then, you know full well that at any given moment, one of these people can do something terrible again. And
well, okay. Well, here's the other thing is that, you know, one of the first things we learn about the Lannisters is they always pay their debts, right?
Right.
And there's no one that is more dangerous to cross than Cersei.
Right.
The fact that she's just been humiliated in that way, it's interesting. It kind of goes back to Joffrey a little bit. Like, the reason he hates Sansa is because she saw what a coward he was with Arya's wolf.
Right.
And so he was never able to play the game with her, put on a veneer with her anymore. She knows he's a coward. And so he has to try to demonstrate his power over her. Well, I think Cersei, in that way, her social currency was completely bankrupt at the end of this episode. Mm-hmm. And then she makes this long walk. And what happens when she goes back in the castle? I'd like to introduce you to Frankenstein's monster, who is not going to rest until all of your enemies are dead.
Right. That was because the thing is, as she makes her way through, you start to have this moment of like, well, I wonder if they broke her.
Sure.
And there is an element where, like, I think when she's in there standing naked in front of everyone that she's responsible for, she then gets handed a weapon.
Right.
A weapon that we have not seen before. Mm-hmm. And so if, in fact, the High Sparrow successfully broke her, there's a monstrous hump. There's a monstrous guy about to put her back together again. Right. I mean, yeah. it's
a little bit,
and you're like,
like,
oh no, Cersei, if anybody's going to not learn from this, or at least going to feel like they need to repay something, it's Cersei with a monster.
We never see how Palpatine becomes evil,
mm-hmm.
but it's almost like Palpatine was kind of evil, and then he had to get run through this ringer and be humiliated. And then at the end of it, someone says, okay, here's all your power back. And by the way, may we present you with Darth Vader?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And the mountains does have a little Darth Vader thing happening, right?
Right, no doubt.
So there was that, and you just kind of like, oh, she is not going to be pleasant.
No. No, because the mountain was already a monster.
Yes.
And now he's an actual monster.
Is Heather upset that Stannis is gone, and are you upset that Stannis is gone?
Kind of. I don't know that she's upset. I think she...
Because she loves Stannis' voice.
She loves Stannis' voice, but, you know, you sacrifice your daughter, and that's kind of a deal breaker for her. I think she was more taken by Brienne leaving her post.
Right.
For vengeance, right? And because I mean, I think, that was super compelling because, you know, here's somebody who's all about the oath. It's all about her oath, right?
Yeah.
Now you could make the argument that she had an oath to Renly, but Renly's gone, and then she switched her oath up.
Yeah, so, but I think that the primary oath. This is a big problem with oaths, and this is Jamie calls us out. He's like, look, you can't keep every oath. And how long did she sit there and wait? I mean, how long can you sit there and wait for a candle in the window?
Well, okay, let me counter that with Stannis is already dead.
Okay, sure.
He's not going to make it out of this.
She doesn't know so, that, though.
Well, the whole thing is wiped out. She saw the army. She knew what it was. They got wiped out. Uh-huh. So... He's already, you know, just because it's not at her hands doesn't mean it's not an inevitability, right? So she leaves the post so she can be the one to off him when he's pretty much already dead to rights. It's like,
yeah, your point is that she wants vengeance more than she wants to help Sansa.
Yeah, so this isn't about the oath. This is about revenge. And so that's where the issue is, right? So it's not a matter of choosing between two oaths because this one is already kind of taking care of itself. And if that was really that big of a deal to you, you would have never taken on this other oath. Mm-hmm. You would have stayed focused on the Stannis thing. You didn't. So leaving her post, that felt, I think, in this house anyway, I think that felt a little, I mean, it adds complexity to the Brienne character. Because I think it could be seen as a little stilted that she's just hell bent and pure. So to have a little bit of a complication like that, I think is helpful for the overall character arc. But it's also like, well,
I love that,
and we're assuming that they jumped into a snowbank and not to their peril, right?
Yeah, that's right. And that actually does happen in the book. Last we hear of Theon, he has rescued fake Arya.
Mm.
And
that's right, because fake Arya is the one.
That's
the
right. So he's rescued fake Arya. Gotcha. Now, what I loved about Stannis going out is that what he says to her is, "Do your duty,"
right?
Because he's all about duty. He's all about like, no, the law says I'm supposed to be king,
right?
And you know that was his whole thing. And, you know, he wants people to do their duty. These guards who let Ramsay and his saboteurs in, they weren't doing their duty. So they're going to have to die. So he respects doing your duty more than anything. Mm-hmm. And he realizes, oh, you are the King's Guard to Renly. Do your duty. I think him going out like that was a very fitting way.
Yeah, I say so. And I also think that from, you know, Stannis is a smart guy. He knew he's going up against the army of the flayed men. You know, having your head lopped off is probably better than what could happen next.
Yeah, that sounds so bad. I think he gets stabbed because I was going to do a dismemberment count. There were a lot of people that lost legs and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah.
I think, all right, so Mel, who's Mrs.
Just certain, bounces.
She just bounces. Oh
my God.
She's been talking a big game throughout this for the last, what, three seasons? She's been talking this right. Big game. Stannis is the prince that was promised, and she just bounces.
Because when she leaves, I'm like, oh, maybe she's got a smoke baby in her butt or something, right? And like you're waiting for something like that, and then she just rides back to the wall and is like, yeah, things are different.
She's like, well, I guess I was wrong about that, but you know, life goes on.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I will return to both themes that we've been covering over these last 10 episodes, that being knighthood and trial by combat. This is an excerpt of my conversation with Steve about the Ridley Scott film, The Last Duel. Only mild spoilers here, and I say mild because I'm introducing a historical fact about the duel that did not make it into the film. But if you are sensitive to even mild spoilers, absolutely stop the podcast now. Here's comic Steve Osborne. My one to grow on is that if ever I need to ride a horse, I'm going to need a staircase.
Yeah,
I want a staircase to get up onto the horse. I want a staircase to get off the horse. I don't know why everyone who needs to be on horseback doesn't have a staircase.
See, I'm at that age where I'm like, stairs. Oof, even that's a chore.
Can we put an escalator next to this animal? Yeah.
So I look at that and go, well, that's great for getting off the horse. But I don't know how you got me up there.
I want to throw out a detail that I learned about Trial by Combat.
Go for it.
The thing that I learned that I didn't know before that you wouldn't learn by watching Game of Thrones is that you were not allowed to fight someone in a trial by combat that wasn't your equal. So in this story, Carouge is a knight. He's been knighted.
Mm-hmm.
But Legree is only a squire. And so before they allowed this trial by combat to happen, they had to promote Legree to knighthood. So he got knighted because he was accused of rape and then challenged to a trial by combat. That's how he got knighted.
That's wild.
It kind of exposes a misplaced mythology around knights.
Right.
You know, that this, you know, these are supposed to be men of honor. Here we have an example of someone who was knighted just so he could fight in this trial by combat.
Right. So now I don't, like, when you see, like, musicians getting knighted, now I don't feel so bad. Like, Sir Sting is fine.
So we could see Sting and Elton John in a trial by combat. Because they're equals.
In fact, I now crave that.
If you'd like to hear the full interview, Cocoons of Horror, search for that wherever you search for podcasts. If you're interested in watching the film, I will say this. It will trigger some folks. It's very heavy, it's very violent, and the film itself deals with rape culture. So keep that in mind before you choose to watch it. And that is all for this week.